next speaker is Gunn Grunwald. It's going about quantum computers, the ultimate hacking machine. I don't know anything about quantum computers. I already heard a lot of it, but I don't understand a thing. So he will show me and you what it is.
Yeah, thank you very much. And amazing to have you guys here in between all the fire shows and other cool things. So I promise I will make this worth your while, because you will actually go home with some very cool knowledge about quantum mechanics, what it really is, quantum computers, how they can hack stuff. And I think I'm here for quite a challenge, first of all, because there's a lot going on in the background, but also because I want this to be an interesting talk, whether you have a bit of knowledge about quantum computers already or not. So maybe you can help me a little. Could you raise your hand if you have literally never heard of anything quantum, if this is completely new to you? Can I see some hands? Ooh, no, nobody. Some people that might be on the edge. Who knows a little bit? Who might have read an article or followed a short course? Ah, that's most of you. Excellent. And who feels like you're sort of you know quite a bit about it? You might not be an expert, but you have read at least a little bit, maybe followed a more advanced course. Ah, a couple of you. Okay, that's excellent. I will mainly do a basic introduction, but if you want me to go any further or so, give some more advanced, answer more advanced questions, I'll be open for questions at the end. And we also have a quantum village just behind the food court where you can walk in all day. We have quantum experts there that you can ask anything, but this is a fantastic basis before you come there. So who am I? I'm Koen Groenland. I work at the University of Amsterdam, and my background is really in the academic side of quantum computing. I did a PhD at QSoft, specifically on the topic of near-term applications that we could do on very small, tiny quantum computers with maybe 10 or 100 qubits like we have today. QSoft is not a startup, it's a research institute. So we turn government money into academic papers. And right now, for the past 5 years, I worked on what we call valorization. That's a term we use when we make academic knowledge practical, when we move that to startup, to developers, to end users that will actually use our knowledge, hopefully in a good way. And what I want to tell you about today, it essentially has three parts. So if you fall asleep somewhere, at the next part you can wake up again. I first want to tell you what the heck this quantum mechanics, what this quantum stuff is. And I also want to go into, I think, a very interesting topic. We're going to talk a lot about Lucy, the cat, who is going to conduct a very scary experiment. She is going to be Schrödinger's cat. And we'll see very soon how that works, and also how we can program something using a Python package and make a simulation of Schrödinger's cat. And lastly, I want to tell you about the impact on encryption. So I want to tell you exactly why quantum computers are kind of scary when it comes to internet security. I'm definitely not telling you everything about quantum computers. If you want to know more, I recently published a book about this, and it's under a Creative Commons license. So you can read it for free at this website, intro2quantum.org. I will show a QR code at the end. So let's get started. I need to tell you what the heck quantum actually is. And for that, we need to go back to the start of the previous century. So around the 1900s, physicists were optimistic. We had kind of solved every problem there was. We figured out electromagnetism. We had Maxwell's laws. We had figured out kind of forces, how to build bridges, how to build tall buildings. There were very few open problems left. It just turned out that there were a few of these open problems that we just couldn't solve until a couple of really smart people started looking at them. The godfathers of quantum mechanics, people like Planck, Einstein, Bohr, Schrödinger, and many, many others. And they started looking at the physics of very tiny, tiny particles, like atoms or electrons. And where physics is really good at predicting, for example, if I kick a ball, how it will fly. We can calculate it very precisely. That physics, what I call classical physics, does not work for an electron at all times. Sometimes we need a new type of physics, that's quantum mechanics. And that's really needed when we look at very tiny particles. And this knowledge was extremely useful. It took us many years to develop it, but in the end, it allowed us to build, for example, MRI scanners or LED lights or the transistor. Like building those really relied on knowledge from quantum mechanics. So that's cool and everything, but I want to talk about what I think is perhaps an even more interesting revolution, which is about quantum computers. We will now make machines, computers, that will use quantum mechanics to store and manipulate information. The information itself will be quantum mechanical, and I'll show you in a bit how that works. But first, let's look at some pretty pictures. This is an example of a quantum computer, the type of computer that IBM and Google are building. And what you see is actually a very large fridge, because the purpose of this thing is to cool stuff, especially at the bottom, where you will have a silicon chip. The purpose is to cool it down to almost exactly zero temperature, or just a thousandth of a degree Celsius above that. So that's -273 degrees Celsius. And all of this is made to cool that thing down to such ridiculously low temperatures, yeah? It's suspended from the ceiling, so the top is kind of room temperature. It's about this big, so you can hug the whole thing. And it has layers. And as you go down to the next layer, it will cool it down to a next step, cool it down to a lower temperature. And all these other things are wires that connect to the qubits that might be at the very bottom to make sure that qubits do what we intend to do with them. For example, we might manipulate them or measure them. This is the picture that you will most often see. But if you walk into the lab at my university, at the University of Amsterdam, the quantum computer looks like this. It looks like a big table filled with optical elements. It's filled with lasers, little mirrors on a stick, crystals that can split beams of light in multiple directions, and especially a big vacuum chamber. And there we can isolate individual atoms, we can move them in space, we can maybe create a cloud or so of 1,000 of them, and if we have them fixed in place, we can shine lasers on them and use all these individual atoms as qubits. Now, I haven't really told you yet what the heck this weird quantum mechanics is, so I want to start with maybe the simplest case. I want to start with a universe with almost nothing in it. The universe only has one blue ball, and the blue ball can be in two locations. It can either sit on a side on the left or on the right. How can we simulate this in a computer? Well, I could make, for example, a list. Right? I might use my favorite programming language, for example, Python. I create a variable that will be a list. And if this blue ball is on the left, the list will be like this. There'll be a 1 in the first entry and a 0 in the second entry. So I just put a 1 where it is. So if the ball is on the right, I have this list. It's 0, 1, so the 1 is on the right-hand side. Easy enough, right? And you might tell me, Koen, you can do that more efficiently with just one bit, but just bear with me, we will need this in a bit. Because sometimes we might run into a situation where we're not completely sure where the ball is. We might want to simulate a probability distribution. In that case, we don't really know where the particle is. It is somewhere, we just don't have the knowledge yet. And we can only describe the likelihood that we will find it in one of these two locations. How can you store that information in a list? Well, of course, we can store the probability distribution, right? We could store something like this. If there's 40% chance to find it on the left, it will be 0.4, and then automatically 0.6 on the other side. Of course, these numbers have to add up to 1. Now, in quantum mechanics, we have something similar. You might have heard that this particle can really literally be in two locations at the same time. And that's weird. When we deal with probabilities, you know, we don't know where it is, but it is actually somewhere. We just haven't checked well enough. In quantum mechanics, this particle can really be at both locations at the same time. The future of the universe depends on it being both left and right. And this phenomenon, we call that superposition. And now, the real clue here, the real part of quantum mechanics is, how are we going to store that information? How are we going to store the state of this system, the state of the universe? And here is the first rule that we need. To store a quantum state, for every position j, left or right, we're going to store one amplitude, a sub j. So I'm going to need two real numbers. So it could look something like this. This position of the particle could be, well, 0.707 on the left, 0.707 on the right. And you might say, Koen, these numbers, they don't add up to one, and that's correct. We'll get back to that in a bit. Actually, they don't have to be real numbers. They can be negative, and they can even be complex numbers. So they're a bit more general than just probabilities. So for example, this is also a valid quantum state. Here the amplitude, for example 0.8 for it to be on the left side, is a little bit higher than the one on the right-hand side. And this again, this represents a quantum state. This is how we can store it and simulate it. Now you might say, Koen, that's weird. How can a particle be really in two locations at the same time? Well, if you look at chemistry lessons, you might have seen this picture of an atom where there's a really, really tiny nucleus, and around that there's a cloud of electrons, or maybe just one electron can form a cloud, which means that it is really at all of these infinitely many locations at the same time. I don't like infinity, so let's go back to our little world where we have just two positions. And here's again a quantum state that you will see a lot, right? This 0.707, 0.707. And then there's another weird thing. I never see a chair in two locations at the same time. I never see a table in two locations at the same time. And that is because whenever we look at something, whenever we observe something, we break the quantum superposition. Whenever we look at something, we automatically measure it. Whenever we obtain information from something, it is always a measurement. And when a measurement happens in quantum mechanics, then a single classical location, J, left or right, is chosen at random. And all we know is the probability. We have to take this amplitude, this number A, we have to take the absolute value and then square it. And you might say, Koen, if you square something, that's automatically a positive number, right? Well, if it's complex, it's not. So that's why we have the absolute value signs. So I guess now these numbers make sense, this 0.707, because if you square that number, you actually get 1/2. So here you really have a 50-50 probability between both outcomes. So let's do that measurement. We're going to look at this quantum particle. What will happen? Bam! All of a sudden, one of these two states is chosen, and now it turned out to be the left one. But maybe the next time, it could have been the right. It's random. So then, just by looking at it, we have actually changed the state of the system. It has changed because now it is actually 1, 0, the regular state for the particle sitting on the left. So just to repeat, whenever we measure, one classical outcome is chosen at random, and we can compute the probability. Now, I can imagine that you're still confused, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Nobody gets quantum mechanics after, I don't know, a 30-minute talk. But I want to do a little experiment with you guys that I hope gives you some intuition. Let's look at this image, and I hope many of you will recognize this. This image actually has two women in it, an old woman and a young woman. I will try to point out both of them. If you want to look at the old woman, she has a very long face. This is the chin all the way down here, the mouth, the nose. This is the eye. So I hope everybody sees the old lady. Is there anybody that does not see it? Oh, let me try it again. So here's a chin, a mouth. This is the nose. This is the eye. Above that is a bunch of hair. I hope that makes sense. There's also a young lady, and she's actually facing away from us. So here, you see her eye and her nose in the middle of this. And this is her chin. And here's her ear, and she seems to have like a sort of an ear bell or so. I hope you see both of the images. And the interesting thing is I cannot see both of them at once. I can look at the image and my mind can wander between the two. I can sometimes see the old lady and then the young lady, and I would like you to do this with me. So you jump between the old lady, young lady, and I want you to do this, and then I'll count 3, 2, 1, and at one you're going to close your eyes and think about what you saw last. Was it either the young lady or the old lady? So do this with me. You see either the young and the old lady, they're alternating, and I'll say 3, 2, 1, close your eyes, please. Think about what you saw last, and you can open your eyes again. And can I see the hands of those that saw the old lady last? Oh, that's great. Roughly half of you. Who saw the young lady last? Ah, that's great. That's 50-50. Of course, this is not quantum, but it is very similar to what happens when we do a quantum measurement. There's really two ladies in this image. Just like a particle can really be in two different states, really at the same time. And when we make a measurement, half of the time you'll see one outcome and half of the time you will see the other. So far, so good. You've now learned about the simplest quantum system, and I will call this a quantum bit, because this left-right system can store exactly one bit of information, at least classically. Now, what if we have two particles? There are now four different classical outcomes, right? I'm going to assume that this blue particle can be in two different locations, the orange one can be in two different locations, and they don't interfere or so. So there's, as you can see, four possible outcomes. And again, I want to generalize this to a quantum particle. So how are we going to simulate this in a computer? What sort of list should we write down now? Well, it's going to be a list with four elements, and we're going to have an amplitude for all of these four possible outcomes. So this is one possibility. It could be 0.5 amplitude corresponding to all four of these options. And again, the probabilities don't add up to one. That's because you first have to square them, and then you get a probability. And if you square all of them, they will add up to one. And here's another perfectly valid quantum state. Again, they don't add up to one, but if you square them, all these numbers should add up to one. Like this. So far, so good. Now you know about 2 qubits. Let's go to 3 qubits. How many possible classical outcomes are there? If I would have 3 possible balls, they can all be in 2 different sites. You should have, well, if I spell them out this way, they could all be on the left, or left, left, right, left, right, left. There should be 8 possible outcomes. I hope that makes sense, right? So let's do a little exercise. What happens if you have 100 particles that can all occupy 1 out of 2 positions? Well, they're going to be quite long lists, right? They could all be on the left, or the rightmost particle could be, sorry, the last particle could be on the right, and then the list goes on. And in the end, I have to sort of multiply 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 1 factor of 2 for every particle that I add. So that's the same as 2 to the power 100. And if I type that into a calculator, it will give me this. It will say that is 10 to the power 30. So 10 to the power 30 is the number of possible outcomes that you could measure. And also the length of this list. Yeah, if I would program this in Python, I would have a list of length 10 to the power 30. Does that fit on my laptop? All of these numbers, let's assume they're all floating point numbers. Let's assume each of these amplitudes, all of these, they occupy 1 byte. So I have 10 to the power 30 bytes to store. How much is that? Let's get a bit of a feeling for that. How much is 10 to the power 30 bytes? And I'm going to count powers of 10. So if I have 10 to the power 0 bytes, well, it's just 1 byte, or 10 to the power 3 bytes, that is a kilobyte, roughly. I can go up 10 to the power 6 is a megabyte, etc. If I keep going, at some point I end up at 10 to the power 18, that's an exabyte. 10 to the power 21, that is a yottabyte. I had to look this up, I'd never heard of it. But this turns out to be the amount of storage, computer storage, on Earth. If you add up all data centers, all DVDs ever produced, everybody's hard drive, you end up with 10 to the power 21 bytes, roughly. But we're still not there. All the storage in the world could not store my quantum state. I have to make another 3 steps of multiplying by 1,000 to get to 10 to the power 30, and I don't even know what name this is. And this is weird, right? Just 100 particles. Imagine having 100 bytes in your computer. That's nothing. So I've been telling you a lot of weird things about superposition, about how incredibly long this list gets. I think here's a famous quote that is sometimes attributed to Niels Bohr. I'm not sure if he actually said it, but I think it's a nice quote. If quantum mechanics hasn't profoundly shocked you, you haven't understood it. And during my studies throughout my career, I encountered this many, many times. I thought I understood it, but every time there is something shocking, even if you get deeper into this topic. But so far, so good. I hope we can accept what we have seen so far. I would like to ask, can we turn this into a computer? Can we use these balls that can be in 2 locations at the same time to compute on data? Well, normally, if we compute on data, at the very basis of a computer, we use electronic circuits or logical circuits. For example, AND and OR gates. And with a circuit like this, you could make an adder, for example, that can add numbers together. The equivalent in a quantum computer looks like this. We have, again, this is a quantum circuit, and here we have horizontal lines. And I made 3 qubits here. Of course, we start counting at 0. These are horizontal lines, and as you go from left to right, they encounter boxes. And each of these boxes is 1 instruction. It changes the state of that qubit. It changes that list of numbers. And there are a couple of rules that you need to take into account. First of all, quantum operations are reversible. That means in particular that the number of lines that go in and the number of lines that go out are the same. And also, all of these operations are linear in terms of mathematics. It means that you can describe them by a matrix multiplication. So there's a, for anybody that has learned linear algebra, there's beautiful and pretty easy to understand math behind this. And I want to show you some of these instructions, some of these quantum operations, and see what they do. For example, there's this one, the NOT operation. It's often called X for some reason. And this is what it does. If a qubit goes in and the state is 100% zero, then what comes out is a 1. And likewise, if you put a 1 in, a 0 comes out. This is a bit flip. So how do you spell this out in terms of these lists? Well, we have this list, right? This meant the 0 state. This is a particle on the left. I'm going to identify the left with 0 and the right with 1. So if this goes in, you can maybe think for yourself, what should come out as a list? It should be the list 0, 1, like this. It's literally moved the 1 to the other location. And of course, if the input is the state 1, which looks like this, the output would be the state 0. It gets interesting when we start with a superposition, right? This is something you will never see in classical computing. This is a particle in superposition. It's mostly on the left with some amplitude 0.8, a bit on the right with amplitude 0.6. So we should keep into account some part of the universe thinks it's actually on the right-hand side and will move it to the left. So I think this amplitude 0.6 should end up on the left where it's flipped to 0. So this should be the outcome. I hope that intuitively made sense. So this is how I define the X operation. And for those who like, you can also write this down as a matrix, and it will look like this. I want to introduce another operation. I'm going to call this the Hadamard, or the H operation. And this is really interesting. We use it a lot in quantum computing, because if you input a 0, the output will be a superposition that is equally 0 and 1. So again, let me try to spell that out in terms of lists. If the input looks like this, a ball that sits on the left, the list reads 1, 0, then the output will be, well, again, these magic numbers that we saw before. Do you remember them? This particle that's in 2 states at the same time, it had this quantum state, 0.707, 0.707. What happens if we input the one state, a ball that sits on the right. Well, it's not trivial to see this, but you will also get sort of an equal superposition, but now with an additional minus sign. And there's something interesting here for people that have seen this before. Many people say, oh, but these things on the right, they're kind of identical, because if you measure them, you both have a probability of 50% to find it on the right or on the left. But you can actually see the difference between these two states on the right, because this H gate is by definition reversible. So I can do the reverse, and I will find two possible outcomes. So it's actually easy to tell these two states apart. So this is another way to look at this situation. There's really a universe in which you have to take into account with two situations. One of them is the ball on the left, and the other one is the ball on the right. I will use this notation with these gray boxes a bit more very shortly. Okay, so we are growing our catalog of quantum gates that we can use. We know the X gate, we know this Hadamard or H gate. You can spell it out like this as a matrix if you want to do that. And there's one more gate that we need to know about. This is the controlled knot, or the CX gate. And it does the following. It acts on two qubits. That's why you see two lines here. And if the top qubit is in the state 1, only then it will apply X to the bottom qubit. And X was our bit flip. So just an example, if I input 0 and 0, what will come out? Of course, nothing happens, right? We get two zeros out. It gets more interesting if I put a 1 here, because now the top qubit is 1, so the bottom one should be flipped. So the top one remains 1, and the bottom one is now flipped, becomes a 1. So again, in terms of lists, you could spell it like this. This is the same input. I input the state 1, 0. And here in this list, I had some freedom of ordering my bits. I chose to order them sort of in binary, like we normally count with numbers. So I identify this entry with the state 1, 0. Or you can see the balls like this. The top ball is on the right. And of course, the output should be like this, right? It moves the bottom qubit, it flips it. So this is the output. Again, a list, but now the 1 is at a different location. If you're curious how to make these gates in practice, how to physically build them, I hope this gives some intuition, especially if I looked at these balls. The orange ball should only move if there's a blue ball here. So I hope you could imagine that these are qubits that I can bring together, and for example, if they are electrically charged, this blue ball might interact with this orange one and move it sideways or so. Now, it gets really interesting if we start with a superposition. For example, with this one, I want to start with a state where the blue ball is both on the left and on the right at the same time. And as a list, it looks like this. The first entry is filled at 0.707, and the third entry there is filled. What will be the output here? What will be the output of this gate? Well, if I follow this correctly, in the left situation here, where the blue ball is on the left, nothing will happen. But in the second situation, where the blue ball is on the right, it will take the orange ball along with it. So what you see on the right-hand side should be what will be the outcome. The balls are either both on the left or on the right. Or if I spell that out as bits, it should be 0, 0 a bit, and also a little bit 1, 1. This is actually an interesting state to look at. Something weird is going on here. Because if I would find the first, if I measure the blue qubit and I find it on the left, it automatically gives me information about the orange, the other bit. If I measure the first, the blue ball on the left, automatically the second qubit has to be on the left as well. I hope that makes sense. There's a whole story behind this. It's called entanglement, but that's a story that I want to tell another day. Let's go back to our catalog of quantum gates. We now have three different gates. This X, which is a bit flip, it flips between 0 and 1. We have this H, which could create superposition. It moves a 0 into 0 and 1 at the same time. And there is this CX, which looks at the top qubit and then flips the bottom qubit. So that was my short intro to quantum. We now know what a quantum ball does, what the properties are, and how we can use them as a qubit. And that brings me to another interesting topic. Can we use this in programming? And for this, I actually want to tell you something about Schrödinger's cat and a little experiment that physicist Schrödinger thought of, where he said, this whole superposition business, that's a bit weird, right? I can believe that an electron is in two locations at the same time, but can I make it bigger? Can I put a chair in two positions at the same time? What if I try a living being? What if I try a cat? Can I force a cat to be dead and alive at the same time? So he thought of this experiment. He took a special kind of radioactive matter and he put it in a vial. And this radioactive stuff works so that the atoms in here can radiate. They can emit a lethal photon. And if the photon hits the cat, it will die. But these atoms, they are quantum mechanical particles. They both emit the photon and they don't emit it at the same time. And during this experiment, we cannot observe it. We don't want to measure. So I've brought a box that is perfectly isolated. No information can go in or out. Really, it's a really good box. So I'm going to put my cat in there and also this radioactive matter. I will close the box. No information can go in or out. And now, after about 10 seconds, these atoms have radiated their radiation. They emitted the photon that will kill the cat, and they did not at the same time. So that means the cat is also dead and alive at the same time. It's really at the same time. Even God does not know what it is. Until you open the box. As soon as I open the box, it's like a measurement. I could notice what has happened. So now it's in a superposition, but as soon as I open it, the measurement takes place, and now the cat is either dead or alive. And in this case, I see a very happy cat. It's still smiling. It still looks good. But of course, we're physicists. We're going to try this experiment again. So I'm once again going to take this vial of radioactive matter, put it in there together with the cat. I'm going to close the box. I'm going to wait for a few seconds until the atoms have both radiated their radiation and not. So it's now in a superposition of dead and alive at the same time. And once you open the box, the measurement takes place. And I'm afraid that now the poor cat did not survive this experiment. These are cute little plushies that you can buy that flip between a dead and alive cat, just like Schrödinger's cat. They're dead and alive at the same time. Okay, so far so good. I hope this experiment makes sense, right? It's interesting. Can we really make a living being that is dead and alive at the same time? And according to quantum mechanics, you can. Then there's a question, can we actually program this? So I'm going to propose this quantum circuit, and I'm going to tell you why this quantum circuit builds something like Schrödinger's cat. What is Schrödinger's cat really? Well, every atom of the cat is both in the location where it is dead and in the location where it is alive. So I want to make a state where maybe all the balls are both on the left at the same time and on the right at the same time. So what this circuit does, first of all, this Hadamard gate. Remember, if the blue ball starts on the left, the output will be the superposition. It's both left and right at the same time. And I also told you what the C-naught did. If the blue ball is on the right, it will take the orange ball with it, like this. And now I can do the same with the green ball. If I do another C-naught, it also moves it there. So now my claim is the output will look like this. All the qubits are either left in the zero state with some amplitude or on the right with some amplitude. So I just want to show you what it would look like if I would program this. And I'm going to show you a bit of a, just very quickly, a programming language and show you that it's not even that hard to write a quantum program. So what I would do is this. I'm going to use a package called Qiskit. So I'm going to say from Qiskit, import an object that is a quantum circuit. The one that we just draw, right? These horizontal lines with gates on them. And I'm going to slowly build this circuit. So let's first define the circuit. QC is my quantum circuit, and I have to tell Qiskit how many qubits we will use. I'm going to use 3 qubits. So there we have our quantum circuit. And as next step, I'm going to add these gates. There's 3 gates that I want to add. Remember? First, there was this H gate, And it has to act on the zeroth qubit, right? We start counting at zero. So this is how we add this H gate to the circuit. What was next? These CX gates. So I'm going to add to this quantum circuit a CX gate. It had to start with the zeroth qubit and act on the first. So there we go. And then the last one. I'm going to start with this quantum circuit, add this extra gate, 0,2. It's going to act on the last qubit. And now I would like to see what I have just made. And there's an instruction for that. So I'm going to take my quantum circuit and ask it to draw it. And there's a fancy option to make it look good, which is using matplotlib. And there's our circuit. It looks the same as what I just showed you. Now, I might like to evaluate this circuit, right? We've now just made a list of instructions. Let's see if we can simulate it. And for that, I'm going to use another option. It's called the state vector. It will go like this. I'm going to import it from Qiskit. And it actually comes from a separate part of it, quantum info, import state vector. That's the one I want to use. So Lucy the cat, she is going to be the state vector that is the result of this quantum circuit. And there we go. Now my computer is running this simulation. It's evaluating the quantum circuit. So let's ask it for the outcome. What is Lucy? Well, it's a list, of course, right? I promise you it would be a list. And maybe I'm just going to print it a bit more pretty. So for J in Lucy, print J. I just want to print all these numbers. And as you can see, indeed, the first entry and the last entry, they have this magic number that we saw before, this 0.707. I think this is very basic, and I kind of like that. Programming a quantum computer is not hard because the programming is complicated. I think it's hard because dealing with quantum states and quantum operations is difficult. But luckily, the language itself is relatively simple. Let's go back to this presentation. I showed you what quantum is. I showed you about Schrödinger's cat. And for the last part, I want to tell you about the impact on encryption. I've not even told you what quantum computers are good at. In fact, are they even useful? Because I would say quantum computers are generally very slow. They are much harder to build than a regular computer. Their clock speed will be much slower. What is the advantage? Well, these new building blocks, this H gate, for example, they allow us to build something that I call quantum algorithms. We can build software that does not run on classical computers, and this software is sometimes better. It's better in the sense that it needs less computational steps, less clock cycles, and that's fantastic. So what can we do with them? For example, we would like to do quantum chemistry, material science, R&D on new materials. For example, design new drugs, develop better batteries, maybe make chemical factories more efficient. We also want to use them for optimization, maybe machine learning. For example, if you want to solve a Sudoku or do image recognition or have a fleet of cars that need to pick people up and bring them to a festival. That's all great, but what I want to talk to you about right now is a very silly task. The task of factoring, and only mathematicians would care about this. So what is factoring? Well, if you have two numbers, 7 and 5, you can multiply them, you end up with 35, and factoring is the reverse operation. So if I give you the number 35, and I ask you to factor it, you have to tell me, oh, that's 7 and 5. And the funny thing is, multiplication is fast, and factoring is slow for a regular computer. So if you have a pretty big number, let's say one with about 2,000 bits, a regular computer can multiply numbers of that size in milliseconds. But doing the reverse can take hundreds of years. And that's why we made this the basis of many crypto systems. We assumed that classical computers cannot do this. And now it turns out that quantum computers can do this plausibly in about a day. And the algorithm that does that is Shor's algorithm. And I want to tell you more about how it breaks encryption. And most people at this point ask me, Koen, Can you tell me, how does that algorithm work? What does Shor's algorithm do? Well, that's very difficult. We have a whole 2-year master program to teach people this. And I can really recommend it. It's a fantastic program. So if you're looking for a master program, do this one at the University of Amsterdam. I can imagine most people don't have that much time to look into this problem. So here's a fantastic YouTube video. It takes about 20 minutes from Minute Physics. And they also explain this really well. Bear in mind, it is a bit technical, but I really liked it. Back to encryption. I want to tell you exactly what encryption is broken and which one is not. And I want to make a distinction between private key cryptography or symmetric cryptography and public key cryptography. Private key cryptography you might recognize from, for example, AES, Advanced Encryption Standard, or TripleDES. And these are relatively safe against quantum computers. We don't have to worry about them too much. And then there's public key crypto, like RSA or elliptic curve cryptography. And there is a big problem now. So we really care about public key crypto. And public key crypto is important. Why? Well, if you want to send private data to a website and you've never seen them before, how can you encrypt your data for them? Or if you receive a software update from Microsoft and you just receive data out of a wall, how do you know that really came from Microsoft and not from some hacker? So this is why we have public key crypto. And public key crypto works in a really cool way. It's kind of amazing that this even exists. In public key crypto, we have two keys. A green one, I'm going to call it a public key, and a red one, a private key. And in this situation, Alice wants to send a message to Bob that should be encrypted. And we're going to use only Bob's key. So Bob can generate the green key and the red key. The public key, the green one, he can just share anywhere. He would, for example, put it on his website. And when Alice wants to send the message to Bob, she would look on Bob's website, look at the public key, and use that to encrypt the message. That message can then safely be sent. Nobody on the internet can read it, except Bob. When he receives it, he has his red key that he can use to decrypt the message. Now, how would quantum computers break into this? What would be the impact of this on the regular internet? Well, let's look at what happens when you visit a website. It's the following. You will first do a key exchange with the server. So in this case, Alice, that will be me visiting a website. I'm going to choose a random number, and I want that to be the key we're going to use for symmetric encryption. So Alice will choose a random session key, K, and she will encrypt it using this public key system. So she's going to ask Bob for his public key. She's going to encrypt the session key, and that results in a ciphertext. And the ciphertext she can safely send over the internet. We call this the encapsulation. And then when Bob receives it, of course, he can decrypt that key. So he retrieves K, and from there on, they're happy. They both have the same K, and they can keep using that. What would a hacker with a quantum computer do? Well, first of all, starting today, you would store all the traffic between Alice and Bob. Whether that's possible is dubious. Some larger powers might actually do this. And as soon as you have a large quantum computer available, it's straightforward to take Bob's public key, remember you just found that on his website, and you can compute the secret key. And with the secret key, you can do everything that Bob could do previously. So again, you only saw the ciphertext, the encapsulation, but you can also decrypt it. You also find this key K, and from there on, all the communication between Alice and Bob, you can decrypt that. Similarly, public key crypto is used to sign software. And again, if you find the secret key, you can also sign software. For example, you could sign updates sent out by Apple, Microsoft, whichever. So that's a big problem. Let me just skip over this because of time, because I just want to drop this. Post-quantum crypto, that's what I think is the best solution. We have cryptography that's secure to both classical and quantum computers. And you might be unsure whether it's safe. And that's why, luckily, cryptographers from all over the world already came together. They tried to find the best solution. The American National Institute for Standards and Technology led a competition. Experts from all around the world submitted their work, and they selected together a new standard. And here we have the solution. We have different primitives. We split them up between algorithms for key exchange and for digital signatures. And they go with names like these, names like MLChem or MLDSA. And these will most likely be the alternatives. We can, in principle, swap out RSA that's broken and use this MLChem system, for example. Or maybe use them both at the same time, so that you need to crack both to get access to somebody's data. So in this case, we can complete the list. Public key crypto is at risk, but we have good alternatives. Now, why is this talk even necessary if we have solved this problem? Well, we're not there yet. Most organizations have thousands of applications that they need to update. Old applications may be hard to update. For example, if you have computers running 24/7 that you don't want to turn off, maybe your packages are deprecated, or maybe you don't even have your code anymore. And lastly, if I ask, for example, the Dutch government how long a typical IT project takes, especially if you're changing fundamental parts of that software, it can easily take 10, maybe 20 years to do that whole IT project. And that's just one of the many projects they need to do. So there's still a long way to go to implement that. And if you want to know more about this whole migration, feel free to talk to me after this talk. I just want to leave it here. You've hopefully learned a bit about what quantum mechanics is, how we can program Schrödinger's cat, and also that we urgently need post-quantum crypto. And if you want to know more, please drop by at the Quantum Village. We have many more to tell you, and you can play many, I think, very cool games. And I also welcome you to check out the book that's free to download as a PDF. I also appreciate if you buy them physically, which should be possible in Europe easily. And I just want to leave you with this comic, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you. There's a mic for questions.
I think somebody's working hard on
it. Hey. Oh, yeah, there we yeah. go. Thank you. I have two questions. First of all, you invited us. If we come to your village, will we find you there or not?
Will you find me at the Quantum Village? Yes, most likely.
Okay.
Or one of my colleagues. There will most the meantime, there will mostly be somebody.
Yeah, and could you please tell the current actual state of this investigation? What can be broken, or is something can be broken or calculated using these quantum computers? Thank you.
So your question is, can something be broken with today's quantum computers? Right now, definitely not. I sometimes see news articles where maybe Chinese scientists have cracked, have maybe factored some number, but today's quantum computers are definitely not good enough. They will need error correction at a serious scale, which is really hard to do, and we expect that we need about 1 million qubits or so to properly do that. We currently can build up to like 1,000.
Next question, please.
Yes, hi. Thank you for the amazing talk. That was really clear. I have a question about your quantum computer. If you have a superposition of some number of qubits and they've done their calculation, how would you actually read out the answer? Because then you break your computer.
That's a very good question. Yeah, you mean the end result could be a large superposition of things, so the outcome is random again.
Yeah.
That's a great question. If you have a quantum algorithm, a good quantum algorithm will create a state in the end that has a very high amplitude on one outcome. So with very high probability, you will measure the correct result. And if you don't, then the algorithm is not a good algorithm.
Thanks.
Hello, thank you for the lecture. Have any of the post-quantum algorithms, encryption algorithms, been implemented in somewhat popular open source software like OpenSSH?
Have post-quantum crypto algorithms been implemented in OpenSSH? Yes, definitely. I'm not sure about OpenSSH, whether it's in the main fork, but for example, Google Chrome already uses, I think by default, a hybrid between this MLChem and conventional elliptic curve cryptography for key exchange. And Signal, the Signal protocol also supports it. And probably many more examples that I don't know.
Thank you for your lecture. I have one more question. Well, how come that public key encryption is so vulnerable for quantum computers and the symmetric key encryption is not? What's the difference? Why is that so the difference is so big?
That's a great question. Why is it that public key crypto is more vulnerable than symmetric crypto? I don't have a very deep answer to this, except that public key crypto does something very special, right? It does more than symmetric key crypto. And you have this relation between a public key and a private key, where the public key could potentially leak information. And in fact, it does, at least in the case of RSA and elliptic curve crypto.
Yeah, but they're very much different. Elliptic curve crypto is very different from RSA crypto.
Come again?
Elliptic curve crypto is very different from RSA crypto, and still they have in common to be very vulnerable.
Ah, yes. It's interesting that both RSA and elliptic curve crypto are both cracked by a quantum computer, by essentially the same algorithm, Grover Shor's algorithm.
Yeah.
And I guess under the hood, they kind of rely on the same generalized problem, the hidden subgroup problem, which is what Shor's algorithm solves. But indeed, if you just look at them from at first face, they seem completely different problems.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for your answer. Yeah.
Any more questions? Then I will thank you.
Thank you.
For you. Tip it.
Oh, yes. Thanks a lot.